the headlines this hour. Iran's leader Ayatollah Khamenei says the Islamic Republic never surrendered in the face of continuous Western propaganda about the collapse of the establishment. Hamas says it is resuming ties with Syria after more than a decade as a delegation of the Palestinian Resistance Movement visits Damascus. And the Russian President Vladimir Putin declares martial law in four regions recently Russia incorporated into its territory from Ukraine amid intense fighting in the areas. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, says his country has always stood up against the West propaganda and will never give in to such a campaign. Ayatollah Khamenei made the remarks in a meeting with hundreds of young Iranian elites and those excelling in scientific fields. He called on the attendees to turn their individual capacities and talents into the capital for the country's progress. The leader also rejected as wrong and unrealistic the notion that the Islamic Republic is on the verge of collapse. He said the enemies have been engaged in such negative campaigns for the past four decades, but Iran's stability and the continuity of its revolution have proven them wrong. Ayatollah Khamenei added that the enemy's hostility and propaganda have failed to impede Iran's progress. The leader said that vibrant academic institutions and scientific ability are testimonies that Iran has been successful in achieving its goals. The Palestinian Resistance Movement Hamas says it is resuming ties with Damascus with the aim to support the Palestinian people and to maintain stability in Syria. Senior Hamas member Khalil al-Hayya made the comment after his meeting with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad in Damascus. He said the resistance movement has notified other countries of its decision to resume ties with Syria. He added that the move will help boost the axis of resistance in the region. He said the meeting with the Syrian president was to send a message to the Israeli occupying regime and its plots. Al-Hayya reiterated Hamas's support for Syria's sovereignty and territorial integrity, saying that the movement is opposed to any move that threatens the Arab country. Bashar al-Assad, for his part, expressed his all-out support for the Palestinian people and their resistance against the Israeli regime. Australia has reversed its recognition of West outlets as the capital of Israel, saying its embassy will remain in Tel Aviv. Canberra expressed its regret about the decision made by the previous administration, calling it political. Australia was one of the few countries with an embassy in Al-Quds.
Australia has reversed a decision made 4 years ago to recognize West outlets as the capital of Israel. Canberra stated that the move had undermined peace and put the country out of step with the majority of the international community.
The Australian government remains committed to a two-state solution in which Israel and a future Palestinian state can coexist in peace and security within internationally recognised borders. We will not support an approach that undermines this prospect.
The Australian Foreign Minister also said the status of Al-Quds should be resolved in negotiations between Israelis and Palestinians and not through unilateral decisions.
Today, the government has reaffirmed Australia's previous and long-standing position that Jerusalem is a final status issue. And a final status issue that should be resolved as part of any peace negotiations between Israel and the Palestinian peoples.
Canberra's announcement angered Israel. Tel Aviv criticised the U-turn by the centre-left Labour government as a hasty decision and summoned the Australian ambassador.
In light of the way this decision was made in Australia as a hasty response to an incorrect report in the media, we can only hope that the Australian government manages other matters more seriously and professionally. Jerusalem is the eternal and united capital of Israel, and nothing will ever change that.
Meanwhile, the Palestinian Authority hailed Australia's move. Palestinian Foreign Minister Riyad al-Maliki described the turnaround as a correction of a mistake previously made by Canberra. The former Conservative government of Australia took this step on Al-Quds after similar moves by the US and a few other countries in 2018. The decision was widely criticized by pro-Palestinian groups as well as the Labour Party. The party, which was then in opposition, promised to reverse the move if it was elected.
The status of Al-Quds is one of the most sensitive issues at the heart of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. In 2018, Australia's Conservative government, led by Scott Morrison, followed then-US President Donald Trump's lead in naming West Al-Quds as the Israeli capital. The move caused a domestic backlash, but the government pushed ahead with the decision nevertheless. Here's a look into what prompted that decision.
Human rights group Australia-Palestine Advocacy Network has praised the Albanese government for differentiating itself from what it called the dangerous political posturing of the previous government. In 2017, then-US President Donald Trump changed 7 decades of American foreign policy by stating that Al-Quds was the capital of Israel. The US relocated its embassy from Tel Aviv to the city the following year. Several countries, including Australia, then followed Trump's lead. Former Conservative Prime Minister Scott Morrison formally recognized West Al-Quds as Israel's capital in December 2018. However, the Albanese government described Morrison's move as out of step internationally and a cynical play to win a by-election in a Sydney electorate with a large Jewish population.
I would say that Mr. Morrison's decision to play politics, and it was no more than that because, of course, we all know where the embassy remained, resulted in Australia's shifting position. I know that this has caused conflict and distress and concern in parts of the Australian community, and today the government seeks to resolve that.
Israel occupied the west part of Al-Quds during a heavily Western-backed war in 1948. It also occupied the Palestinian territory of the West Bank, including East Al-Quds, in another war in 1967. Ever since, the regime has dotted the territory with hundreds of illegal settlements that have come to house hundreds of thousands of Israeli settlers. Palestinians want the West Bank as part of a future independent state with East Al-Quds as its capital. The Israeli regime, however, lays claim to the entire city as its so-called capital. However, Israeli sovereignty over Al-Quds has never been recognized internationally.
The Russian President Vladimir Putin has declared martial law in 4 Ukrainian regions that recently joined the Russian Federation following referendums.
Martial law was in effect in the Donetsk People's Republic, the Luhansk People's Republic, in the Kherson and Zaporizhia regions since their entry into the territory of Russia. And now it is therefore necessary to apply this law within the Russian legal framework. Therefore, I have signed a decree on the introduction of martial law in these 4 subjects of the Russian Federation.
Putin confirmed his move during a televised National Security Council meeting. The martial law allows the strengthening of the military, imposing curfews, and putting limits on the movement. Putin said that he took the decision as the Ukrainian authorities ignored the will of the people, rejected any proposals for negotiations, and continued to kill civilians. The Kremlin has already published the presidential decree, saying that martial law will go into effect from early Thursday. Last month, Russia incorporated the 4 regions into its territory after people voted overwhelmingly to secede from Ukraine. The West, however, called the referendums a sham. The new development comes as Ukraine is trying to recapture the territories held by Russia forces for months. Citizens and pro-Russia officials are evacuating from the main city in Kherson region, just as Ukrainian forces are pushing to take back the area from Russia. The leader of Kherson says that the entire administration is moving to the left bank of the Dnieper River. Still, he is pledging that Russian forces will fight to death to defend the region. According to the official, over 60,000 people will be evacuated within the next 6 days. Earlier, the commander of the Russian forces in Ukraine described the military situation as tense and difficult around Kherson. Sergei Serovikin said Ukrainian forces are deliberately targeting the infrastructure and residential buildings. Iran doubles down on its earlier stance that it has not supplied weapons to Russia to be used against Ukraine, saying that it is ready to talk to Kiev and to resolve any such allegations. The foreign ministry spokesman says those claims are untrue and based on false information. According to Nasser Kanani, the accusations are part of the Western propaganda campaign against Tehran. Kiev and the West claim that Russia has been using Iranian-made drones to strike Ukrainian cities in recent weeks. The Kremlin has denied that, saying that it uses Russian-made weapons in the strikes. Also, certain Western media have cited U.S. security officials, saying that more Iranian drones, as well as missiles, are headed towards Ukraine. Pentagon has not confirmed those reports, but said that it will take steps to make the sale of Iranian drones harder. Ukraine has also threatened to cut diplomatic ties with Iran, but Tehran says it holds a neutral stance and believes the dialogue is the best way to end the war. Divisions remain in the European Union over how to deal with the bloc's energy crisis. Tens of thousands of businesses in the EU face the prospect of going bust due to rising electricity prices. Jerome Hughes has more from Brussels.
Abdullah Hassan runs a modest grocery store close to Brussels city centre. He only uses three refrigerators and turns them off for part of the day. Customers are complaining to him about rising prices at the checkout. The store might be modest, but his energy bills are certainly not.
I used to pay 250 euros per month for just electricity, not the gas. I don't have gas here. Now they suggested me to increase my monthly bill to 850 euros. That's more than the triple. That's incredible. I cannot pay with a small business like this.
The move by EU leaders to cut Russian gas imports by two-thirds is taking its toll. It costs a fortune to import liquefied natural gas from the US. It's good for America, but not for EU citizens. The European Commission wants the EU's 27 countries to buy gas as one single client by April.
Europe's energy demand is very large, so it is logical that instead of outbidding each other, the member states and the energy companies should leverage their joint purchasing power.
The European Commission has just presented a new emergency regulation designed to fight high energy prices and ensure security of supply. But many experts say it is clear sanctions against Moscow over the conflict in Ukraine will continue to backfire. As desperate citizens look to alternatives, extreme anti-EU political parties in the bloc are gaining ground. It's for this reason that many analysts are saying EU leaders might look back on their handling of the Ukraine-Russia question with enormous regret. Billions of euro are being pumped by the EU into Ukraine's government and army. We do not hear any mention of peace negotiations. A countless number of business people in the EU, like Abdullah, are anxiously wondering for how much longer it will be feasible to keep their doors open. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The British Prime Minister Liz Truss has faced tough grilling in Parliament over her controversial tax cuts plan that she was forced to abandon. The opposition Labour Party leader Keir Starmer mocked Truss over her U-turn.
I've got the list here. 45p tax cut, gone. Corporation tax cut, gone. 20p tax cut, gone. Two-year energy freeze, gone. Tax-free shopping, gone. Economic credibility, gone. And her supposed best friend, the former Chancellor, he's gone as well. They're all gone. So why is she still here? Yeah. Why on earth would anyone trust the Tories with the... No.
Starmer was taking aim at the Premier during a question time session held less than 2 days after the new finance minister said that he will reverse almost all tax measures announced by his predecessor. Another Labour MP, Sarah Owen, called on Truss to step down, saying that it is better for her to quit and to call a general election. Truss, however, brushed aside those calls. She boasted her resolve to keep fighting, despite growing voices questioning her ability to rule the country.
Mr. Speaker, I am a fighter and not a quitter.
Meanwhile, Truss's popularity has dropped significantly within her Conservative Party. Polls indicate that she has become the most unpopular prime minister just 6 weeks in office. At least five Tory MPs have demanded a substitute for her in Downing Street. Truss is under fire for a so-called mini-budget, which intended to slash a host of taxes without a curb on spending. The plan that was unveiled in late September sent markets into turmoil and led to a drop in the value of the British pound against the dollar. Afterwards, she sacked her close ally, Kwasi Kwarteng, as finance minister. The newly appointed Chancellor of the Exchequer, Jeremy Hunt, has reversed the decision to cut taxes for the richest earners and the companies making profits. Somebody else who has emptied her support for Truss, Braverman, in which she has said that she had serious concerns about a government commitment, as she called it, to honor pledges made to voters. So you have this particular politician, the UK Interior Minister, Suella Braverman, leaving the government of what now many are calling the unpopular Prime Minister Liz Truss. So that's another major position that was supporting Truss to now vacate her support for Truss. An inquiry has been launched in England aiming to discover the causes of recent unrest between Muslims and Hindus. Throughout this year, footage has gone viral showing Muslims and Hindus in English Midland cities of Leicester and Birmingham engaging in street battles. Rob Carter brings us the latest on this story.
Following weeks of unrest between Muslims and Hindus in the English Midlands city of Leicester, the local mayor has ordered an inquiry to get to the bottom of what's behind the rise in local tensions. Following the inquiry's launch, Leicester City Mayor Peter Salisbury met with local Muslim community activists on October the 11th, who expressed fears that the violence was largely the result of the arrival of an Indian Hindu supremacist political ideology known as Hindutva on British shores. A Press TV investigation into the unrest found that a number of local Muslim residents had been hospitalized this year following attacks allegedly carried out by Islamophobic Hindu gangs, likely inspired by India's Hindutva ideology.
However, it isn't just Muslims who fear the arrival of Hindutva. British Sikhs are also well acquainted with the supremacist ideology, which preaches total intolerance of all of India's religious minorities.
The Hindutva is a fascist ideology that seeks the racial, social, religious purity of India and unification of India as an embodiment of Hinduism. So one nation, one language, and now with Modi, one market, where the Hindu is the human, the Hindu is the subject that is protected, and every other minoritized community is a threat, a potential threat to the integrity of India. It's a mythical project.
Hindu organizations in Britain have condemned the violence, but none seem to have acknowledged the accusations of Hindutva-inspired hate as a cause to the troubles. Muslim and Sikh onlookers hope that the inquiry will put the Hindutva ideology firmly under the spotlight. Robert Carter, London.
And that is it for World News. Bye-bye for now.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
in the limelight.
The Zionist regime, in a blatant and barbaric move, has authorized its military to kill Palestinians with drones in the West Bank. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for the second part, please. The website of New Arab wrote in this regard, "The Israeli regime army chief of staff decision in September to allow the use of armed drones in targeted killings in the occupied West Bank has raised concerns about the humanitarian and legal implications of such a policy. The Israeli media had reported that the Israeli army was preparing to implement the use of drones in military raids. Such incursions, numbering more than 2,200 so far in 2022, have in recent months included the targeted killings of Palestinians, especially in Nablus and Jenin. These raids are generally carried out by the Zionist regime's special forces and are frequently confronted by Palestinians, turning into hours-long gun battles. However, the reported green light by the Zionist regime chief of staff, Aviv Kochavi, to carry out targeted killings using armed drones could have profound legal and human rights consequences on an entirely different level. The Zionist regime began the practice of targeted killings through airstrikes in the West Bank during the Second Intifada. The first aerial assassination in the West Bank by the Zionist regime was the killing of Hossein Abayat, a Fatah Palestinian leader in Beit Lah in November 2000. He was killed when the Zionist regime Apache helicopters launched missiles at a van he was traveling in. Besides Abayat, two Palestinian civilians aged around 50 were killed and six other civilians were wounded in the incident. Despite civilian casualties, the Zionist regime Supreme Court ruled in 2006 in favor of allowing targeted killings in all the forms. In the following years, the tactic was used mostly in the Gaza Strip, especially through airstrikes, often causing heavy civilian casualties. Tahsin Alian, a Palestinian legal expert, told the New Arab, "This is the first concern when it comes to drone killings, that they will most probably cause civilian casualties. Apache helicopters during the Second Intifada were manned by pilots and still they killed innocent people, almost with each strike. Drones are machines, and it is proven by experience in other countries that they kill innocent victims more often than not." According to the Bureau of Investigative Journalism Statistics, between 8,858 and 16,901 people have been killed in some 14,040 U.S. drone strikes in Pakistan, Yemen, Afghanistan and Somalia since 2010. Between 910 and 2,200 of the victims were civilians, and 283 to 554 were children. But aside from civilian casualties, the use of drones for targeted killings raises a more fundamental concern. According to the European Center for Constitutional and Human Rights, U.S. drone warfare often violates international law, such as strict rules and basic human rights, namely the right to life and physical integrity, by attacking individuals without sufficiently determining their status. According to the Israeli human rights group B'Tselem, the targeted assassination of Palestinians also classifies as an extrajudicial killing. The extrajudicial killing of Palestinians is already a current concern, pointed out Tahsin Alian, adding, they will most probably increase with the introduction of drones due to eased Israeli rules of engagement and the increased capacity of killing anyone, anywhere, by drones. Last week, following a briefing to the Israeli media, a Zionist army spokesperson told Israeli journalists that drone attacks would be used only in case of an immediate need to eliminate a threat and not as a policy of resuming assassinations. However, the Zionist regime's army's green light of drone killings comes in the midst of an ongoing escalation in the West Bank, where Israeli regime forces have already killed 165 Palestinians during military raids into Palestinian towns and cities, including several targeted killings of Palestinians in northern West Bank. Mohammad Rai, a human rights activist based in Nablus, told the New Arab, people are worried about the possible use of drones in killings because they are sure that civilian casualties will increase. For the last 2 weeks, Israeli drones haven't left the skies of Nablus, and although they are most probably not armed drones, their sound makes everybody nervous, he said, adding, my family and I, as well as our neighbors, feel already threatened by Israeli raids, and drones make it even more difficult to live our daily lives, thinking that they might soon begin to fire. I personally hope that the Israeli occupation doesn't begin to kill with drones, because we all know that it was targeted killings that exacerbated the situation during the Second Intifada and prolonged the violence. Osama Hanini, a younger engineer in Ramallah, told the New Arab, adding, the current situation, which is already loose and uncertain, would become even more violent and complicated. Tahsin Alian remarked, there is no guarantee that the number of killings would not increase after the introduction of drones. Taking into account that the Israeli definition of an immediate threat is loose and not objective, the use of drone technology would most probably result in more human rights violations, unlawful killings, and civilian casualties.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhalladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis-sabri was-salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear audience of IRIB English Radio, now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sayyid Asad Jafari.
There's a beautiful hadith in the beginning of Sheikh Kulayni, rahmatullah alayhi's Al-Kafi, in this book, Kitab Aql wa Jahl. He presents this hadith where Jibreel comes to Nabi Adam alayhi salam and says to Nabi Adam that I'm going to present to you three things. You are to choose one and let the other two go. What are those three things? The first thing is that I will present to you aql, the intellect. The second is I'll present to you deen, religion. The third, I'll present to you haya, modesty. These are the three on the table. Choose one and let the other two go. Okay. The hadith says that Nabi Adam chose the aql. I want the aql. Now the hadith says that at that moment, and it personifies both deen and haya, the deen and haya, religion and modesty, now in turn turn to Jibreel and say, we've been instructed by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that wherever the aql goes, we have to go with it. It's a very important hadith. The bunyad and base of our deen is the intellect. At the height of our happiness is the intellect. At the height of our sadness and grief is the intellect. At the same time, Islam places a high emphasis on grief and connects the two sometimes. That the weakening of the intellect sometimes is because of the hardening of the heart. Or the locks on the heart is due to the fact of the weakening of the intellect. I'll give you an example. The example is that of the famous story of the golden cow during Nabi Musa's time. Okay, very famous story, very lengthy one. I won't narrate the entire story. It's enough for all of you to know, and all of you know this. Alhamdulillah, you have strong ulama come in and out of this building. That somebody from the Bani Israel tribe now is killed. They want to know who killed him. They go to Nabi Musa and they ask him, can you please ask your Lord to tell us what happened? Your Lord. He's not their Lord just yet. So Nabi Musa now, of course, where he comes down, and the instructions are for them to find a cow, rub the cow against the mayyat. The mayyat will come to life, and he himself will tell you who killed him. Now, one of the most beautiful lessons of this story is the fact that these were simple instructions that were made very difficult for some reason, because of the fact that these were people who asked constant questions, and they made a very simple act, a very difficult one, that cost them a lot of money. And sometimes we do the exact same thing. The deen is so simple, we make it so difficult. Khair. So finally they find this unique, one-of-a-kind, one-in-a-lifetime golden cow, and all they're asked to do is simply rub the tail against the mayyat, comes alive now, just like Allah says, tells the people so-and-so killed me. And the Quran captures this story. In the end now, I want you to imagine all of you, me as well, they're witnessing this miracle. Can you imagine? Imagine now a mayyat coming to life, speaking and saying so-and-so killed me. All based on the Rabb of Musa. Now that would be enough for someone like me, and maybe and hopefully someone like all of you, to accept the Rabb of Musa. But this was the Bani Israel tribe. They were very difficult people. After all of that, after witnessing that, they still didn't understand. Allah says, I did this la'allakum ta'aqilun. So you can be amongst the ahli aql. So you can see the deen through the intellectual lens. And right away, right after that, the Quran describes why these people rejected this. ثُمَّ قَسَتْ قُلُوبَكُمْ مِنْ بَعْدِ ذَلِكَ It's because your hearts now have hardened. And then it goes on to describe the types of rocks and how it, you know, the metaphor for the hardening of the hearts is a beautiful verse. That's very, very poetic and very, it's you know, there's a beauty in that verse that I won't go into. It's enough to know that it's important that right after discussion on the aql, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says that this hardening of the heart has not allowed your aql to now become roshan, as they say in Farsi, turned on. Now, in the discussion on the aql, let me break this down a little bit more. In the world of theology, there is something called aqli ma'ash and aqli ma'ad. Mim ayn alif sheen, mim ayn alif dal. Okay? Aqli ma'ash, aqli ma'ad. If you know a little bit of Arabic, you already know what each type means. Okay. Now, there is the role of the aql, the intellect. There is the power of the intellect, what it's supposed to do. That's all a different akhlaqi discussion in Islamic ethics. But for our purpose, then, and I'm going somewhere with this, we have to understand these two categories. Aqlim ma'ash, aqlim ma'ad. Aqlim ma'ash are those everyday logical decisions that you and I make for our life. Whether it's, for example, where to apply for schooling, what degree to attain, what line of work to go into, where to have our dinner, what clothes to buy, for example, what spouse to marry, for example, how many kids to have. All these things are what's called aql-e ma'ash. The everyday decisions making that we use for everyday life. Okay? Aql-e ma'ad, if you know what ma'ad is another word to use for qiyamah, the day of judgment. the hereafter. So if aql and ma'ash are those intellectual decisions that we make for our everyday life in this world, aql and ma'ad are those decisions we make for the hereafter. Coming here, for example, going for hajj, for example, waking up for fajr when that blanket is singing that lullaby to you, you just found your spot in your bed, very comfortable, warm blanket, and that 4 a.m. alarm goes off. Going for ziyarat, fasting in the month of Ramadan, giving your khums, all that aql and ma'ash. It requires an intellectual discussion. Now the ulama have gone one step further. We understand those basic terms fine. What's the point? The point is that eventually your aql and ma'ad becomes your aql and ma'ash. There's kamal in that. That's the mu'min's perfection. That every nitty-gritty detail that we think about with our intellect in our everyday life has a ukhrawi impact. An impact in the hereafter. It's very easy to find God in this farsh, on this farsh, in these ayam. Sometimes putting on our clothes and choosing our, for example, restaurant, or choosing our spouse to find God in that is not an everyday common thing. I remember one time in the Hausa, I had these little stories here and there that are treasures for me at least. My teacher would stop his class and give a little bit of a darse akhlaq for us, because you know these were spiritual fathers for us as well, not just teachers of a book. And he would say, look, there are five categories of everything that you do, correct? Wajib, haram, makruh, mustahab, and mubah. Sheik? You know those definitions? Mubah, of course, is pretty much everything that doesn't fall in the first four, falls in mubah. The everyday acts. He says that your journey in life, in everything that you do, from the happiness to the sadness to the everyday life to the once-in-a-lifetime event, all of it now is to make sure you take these five and you break them down even further to the point where mubah is removed from your equation. Understand my point. Mubah are those acts that we do every day that don't really have a ruling behind them. For example, changing your clothes. For example, combing your hair, for example. Right? Driving your car. Getting ready for work. We don't really attach a, you know, wajib, mustahab, makruh title to those things. But he says when your ma'ash becomes your ma'ad, then the mubah is removed and every act you do is either mustahab or makruh or wajib or haram. That's a big level to achieve. We're talking the urafa, the awliya, the mystics, the big ulama.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahim كريم عظيم عليم حليم حكيم متين غفور شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد صلي على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا عليه.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight.
The British government has spent the past few weeks turning announcements about taxation and spending into moments of political theatre. On 23rd of September, a fiscal event dubbed the mini-budget introduced the largest package of tax cuts in half a century. A medium-term fiscal plan eventually scheduled for 31st of October was to set out the more trivial details, like how it would be paid for. On 17th of October, Jeremy Hunt, the new Chancellor of the Exchequer, cancelled £32 billion of those tax cuts, ripping up virtually the whole of the mini-budget. We take a look at the British media's coverage of this story. The British newspaper The Guardian has more on this story. Jeremy Hunt has shredded Liz Truss's economic plans in one of the most astonishing U-turns in modern political history, including slashing the energy price freeze, which the Prime Minister had repeatedly championed. The new Chancellor of the Exchequer dismantled almost all of the platform that Liz Truss's leadership victory had been built on, including the majority of her tax cuts, and hinted a new windfall tax was in his sights. A move that the Prime Minister had previously said she would not countenance. Jeremy Hunt also refused to rule out cuts to totemic Conservative pledges, including defence spending and the pensions triple lock. Liz Truss declined to appear at the dispatch box in Parliament on Monday, 17th of October, despite calls from Labour, leading one Cabinet Minister to clarify that she was not hiding under a desk. In an interview with the BBC on Monday night, she said she wanted to accept responsibility and say sorry for the mistakes that have been made. "I wanted to act to help people with their energy bills and to deal with the issue of high taxes, but we went too far and too fast," she said. With her premiership in grave doubt, sources at No. 10 Downing Street told The Guardian that Liz Truss met Sir Graham Brady, the powerful chair of the 1922 committee, where they discussed the scale of Conservative MPs' anger. A new poll from Redfield and Wilton gave Labour a 36-point lead, the largest for any political party from any polling company since October of 1997. In a statement on Monday morning, Jeremy Hunt said the 20p basic tax rate would remain indefinitely and reversed a swathe of other tax measures, including changes to dividend taxes, a VAT-free shopping scheme, and a freeze on some alcohol duties. But the biggest shock came when the Chancellor said he would no longer guarantee energy prices for the next two winters, and that more targeted measures would replace the universal guarantee from next spring after a Treasury review. It means the average annual energy bill will rise to more than £4,000 from April. According to the sector's leading forecaster, and analysts say it could lead to a rise of almost 5 percentage points in the annual inflation rate. Inflation currently stands at 9.9% and is expected to rise slightly when the figure for September is announced on Tuesday. The Institute for Fiscal Studies said the £32 billion tax increases, the biggest since 1993, would not be enough on their own to undo the damage caused by the debacle of the past few weeks. Paul Johnson, the think tank's director, said the Chancellor's decision to scrap most of the tax cuts announced last month was welcome, but would not be enough to plug the gap in the government's fiscal plans. Jeremy Hunt will use his next fiscal statement, due on 31st of October, to outline how the government intends to reduce public sector debt as a share of national income over time. Estimates of what it would take to achieve this range between £60 billion and £72 billion. The only key tax announcement to survive were the cancellation of the national insurance rise and stamp duty changes, both already subject to new legislation. Jeremy Hunt refused to rule out changes to the pension's triple lock and said a new windfall tax on energy profits was on the table. "I'm not against the principle of taxing profits that are genuine windfalls," he told the House of Commons. Few in Westminster believe Liz Truss's premiership is secure, even with the significant reversals. One member of the 1922 executive said the group could take action this week, either by changing the rules or sending Sir Graham Brady to tell Liz Truss it was over. "When the herd moves," they said. The Economist magazine gives us more details about the same story. Jeremy Hunt was rushing to calm financial markets that his predecessor as Chancellor, Kwasi Kwarteng, had well and truly spooked. Britain's currency and its government debt or gilts cratered in the wake of growth plan that Mr. Kwarteng laid out on 23rd of September. The gilt sell-off was so sharp that it forced some pension funds into fire sales, creating a self-reinforcing feedback loop and threatening financial instability. An emergency bond-buying program from the Bank of England, along with Mr. Kwarteng's defenestration, went some way to restoring order. But as the central bank's intervention came to an end on 14th of October, gilt yields, which move inversely to prices, were rising ominously once again. Jeremy Hunt's statement today was designed to reassure the markets once and for all that the government is fully committed to fiscal responsibility. It has brought some much-needed breathing space. The 30-year gilt yield, which breached 4.8% on Friday, fell back to 4.4%. The pound, worth less than $1.12 on Friday, rose to around $1.14. But the price of all this has been the wholesale destruction of the tax-cutting agenda that brought Liz Truss to power. She had already announced the reinstatement of a corporation tax rise she had previously promised to scrap, and before that, reversed the move to abolish the top rate of income tax. In addition, Jeremy Hunt today cancelled promised cuts to the basic rate of income tax and the dividend tax rate, as well as a planned freeze on alcohol duty rates and a VAT-free shopping scheme for visitors to Britain. A cut to national insurance, a payroll tax, remains, for now at least. So does a small cut to stamp duty, a tax on property transactions, as well as some other bits and pieces. But Liz Truss's economic programme is virtually dead. So is the philosophy that underpinned it, that tax cuts could pay for themselves by stimulating economic growth. The wing of the Conservative Party that advocates sound money is firmly in the ascendancy. But more pain is to come. Jeremy Hunt also promised a review of the blank cheque the government signed in offering to protect households and businesses from higher energy costs, aiming to make it more targeted and less expensive after April of 2023. Prior to his statements, Britain's public finances faced a hole in the medium term, reported to be around £70 billion per year. Taken together, the Chancellor's announcements may take the shortfall down to around £40 billion. Jeremy Hunt warned of difficult decisions ahead. Mr. Hunt's extraordinary elevation has been as striking as Liz Truss's political implosion, after two unsuccessful tilts at the party leadership. Until a fortnight ago, Jeremy Hunt's career in high office seemed to be over. He finished second behind Boris Johnson in the Conservative Party's leadership contest in 2019. In the contest of 2022, he gathered the support of just 18 MPs. His background as a Remainer made him an unlikely fit for a party that has become more dogmatic since the Brexit referendum of 2016. Now he is the prime minister in all but name. Yet even he is not really in charge. For the foreseeable future, Britain's fiscal policy will be dictated not by what its politicians want, but rather by what the bond markets will bear.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Virtues of the Believers, Friday the 3rd of Ramadan, 1394, the 20th of September, 1974. Some people feel happy when they pray alone. Instead of 17 rak'ah a day, they offer 51 rak'at a day, not to mention other recommended prayers. Someone tells them people are leaving the religion in droves. This does not concern them. As Sa'adi says, they pull their own rug back from the wave. They say, it's hard enough to save ourselves, let alone anyone else. Some people think this way. But the kind of action that is a mark of faith is not this. Anyone who prays well but prays by themselves without any concern for the prayers of others, this is not correct. It is not, as we said, complete. What is the mark of true faith? Maintaining the prayer. Maintaining it by praying in a community, by making everyone worshippers, although not necessarily in the sense that everyone worships together. I want you to think beyond the words. I want you to think more broadly. Words are too small to express this. This doesn't mean that we make the person who doesn't pray say his prayers. It means making a community which prays, a community which is always mindful of Allah and is always following the path of Allah. A community which says, You alone we worship and your aid alone we seek. The Quran, Surah 1, verse 5.
دنیای اسلام
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
A community that only worships and serves Allah, and a community that relies on no one except Allah. A prayerful community means one which in its daily life distances itself from the leaders of corruption, those upon whom is Allah's wrath, مَغْضُوبِ عَلَيْهِمْ, and those who follow corruption, those who are astray, ضالين, the Quran, Surah 1, verse 7. This is what prayer means. If someone tries to make other people prayerful in this sense, this is a mission done in the service of the truth, for the sake of removing corruption, for the sake of removing us and them, for the sake of the unity of a society and the unity of all human beings. This is what it means to maintain the prayer. In other words, you do something so that everyone, five times every day, will repeat the words, "You alone we worship, and your aid alone we seek. Allah, we only serve you. We only bend to you and to no one else." Five times every day, they will disassociate from those who have incurred your wrath, مَغْضُوبِ عَلَيْهِمْ, and those who are astray, ضَالِّينَ, from the leaders of corruption and the followers of corruption.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.